Welcome to the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine. Meet him, greet him, treat him, and street him. Today's date is November 11th, 2017, and I am your skeptical host, Ken Milne. The title of today's podcast is Some Like It Hot, Emergency Department Temperature and ICU Survival. And our guest skeptic comes from all the way on the other side of the world. It's Jesse Spurr, who works as a nurse educator in the emergency department at Red Cliff Hospital. Outside his family and work, Jesse pours his energy into his professional hobbies. Healthcare Simulation Podcast, Simucast, Nurse Practice Development Blog and Podcast, Injectable Orange, and faculty and team member of The Teaching Course. Jesse classifies himself as a lifelong student of teaching, learning, health, and human performance. Welcome to the SGEM, Jesse.
Thanks, Ken. I'm sure you get this all the time, but I am a serious groupie of the SGEM. I've learned so much about critical appraisal and just general healthy skepticism, plus fueled by an appreciation for cheesy rock music from the years of tuning in each week.
Well, thank you very much for your kind words, but I will take issue with the term cheesy because it's 80s music. It's all so good.
I mean it in the finest possible way. Top level cheese.
Top level cheese. Well, I remember when we first met in Chicago and I asked you, why is your blog called Injectable Orange?
Well, I recall our first chat running along the banks of Lake Michigan, and from memory, you were wearing one of your trademark Bat Doc running shirts, actually. Injectable Orange, I get asked this question a lot, is a throwback reference to the very first type of simulation that many of us participate in, which is literally learning to inject on oranges. And to my knowledge, it's still used to this day in many nursing schools.
I, too, remember that run along Lake Michigan, you and I. It was just the two of us that one morning, and it was so great getting to know more about you, what you were doing, and here we are a few years later, finally getting to do an episode of the SGEM together.
Yeah, it's taken time, but I'm really excited about it.
Well, we are recording this on November 11th, so I think it is important, Jesse, that we recognize those people that have sacrificed for our liberty and our freedom and the ability to be able to do something like this, that we have a somewhat peaceful globe and you and I can connect and put out some hopefully high-quality FOMED and cut that knowledge translation window down from over 10 years to less than 1 year.
Yeah, I agree completely.
All right, well, let's get started with a case.
Okay. You're working on a night shift in the emergency department. Two patients present to the front desk in really close succession, brought in by concerned family members. Both are similarly hypertensive, tachypneic, drowsy but orientated, with hot, reddened, and increasingly painful cellulitis of their lower legs. Following the triage sepsis pathway, recently amended to use QSOFA, the nurse triages both to beds in the high acuity area of the department. Each patient is seen quickly and has initial vital signs and blood samples obtained. One patient has a temperature of 38.3 degrees Celsius and the other 35.5 degrees Celsius. Being a night shift, staff resources are very tight. How do you allocate resources wisely?
Well, if you work in emergency medicine, you're probably aware of the continuous debate about fever. Is it harmful? Is it helpful? Should it be treated?
This comes up in practice just about every day in the interfaces between emergency medical services. There are generally two opposing schools of thought about this, I guess, about the value of fever in infection. One side argues that fever causes an increased metabolic stress that might be detrimental to already sick patients. The other side points out that fever is a natural immune response designed to fight infection. So potentially eliminating this natural line of defense could make sick patients even sicker.
Well, we have covered fever before on the SGEM. There was a great episode on pediatric fever fear with PEDS EM superhero Anthony Crocco. And he also did a rant-thony on pediatric fever fear, which you can watch on YouTube.
I feel like keeping that rant-thony on my phone ready to just hold up and play to other people when we're having a little bit of a healthy debate about this in practice. But the American Academy of Pediatric Guide says fever in and of itself is not known to endanger a generally healthy child. In contrast, fever may actually be of benefit. Thus, the real goal of antipyretic therapy is not to simply normalize body temperature, but to improve the overall comfort and well-being of the child.
Well, there were three questions we covered in that pediatric fever fear episode. The first question was, should parents combine or alternate acetaminophen and ibuprofen?
What came out of that episode was parents and caregivers should really focus on patient comfort instead of normalizing a temperature in febrile children. Alternating therapy may be beneficial for comfort, but more research is required to address this specific question.
Well, the second question was, will treating a fever make the patient sick longer?
Probably not. Antipyretics should be used to improve comfort during an illness.
And the third question was, will treating with antipyretics prevent a febrile seizure?
Antipyretics appear to offer no significant improvement in the recurrence rates of febrile seizures in children.
Well, when looking at fever in adult ICU patients, we did an episode with Justin Morgenstern from First 10 EM. Great website. The question in SGEM number 146 was, does regular administration of intravenous acetaminophen in febrile ICU patients being treated for a known or suspected infection impact the number of ICU-free days?
The HEAT trial. The routine use of IV acetaminophen, or paracetamol as we call it here in Australia, for the treatment of fever in ICU patients thought to be due to infection cannot be recommended at this time.
All right, so let's get to the clinical question that we're going to ask for this episode of the SGEM.
Okay, so for this episode, we're looking at the clinical question, does patient body temperature in the emergency department predict survival of patients with severe sepsis or septic shock admitted to the intensive care unit?
And what's the reference, Jesse?
The reference is Sundén Kullberg et al. Fever in the emergency department predicts survival of patients with severe sepsis and septic shock admitted to the ICU. And it's from Critical Care Medicine in 2017.
As a listener of the SGEM, you know we've got to run through the PICO. So what was the population?
The population in this study was adult patients aged greater than 17 years with documented diagnosis of severe sepsis or septic shock admitted to one of 30 Swedish intensive care units within 24 hours after presentation to the emergency department.
Now, because of the study design, there wasn't an intervention, but what was their comparison?
The comparison was four stratified groups of body temperatures. So they were separated to below 37 degrees Celsius, 37 to 38.29 degrees Celsius, 38.3 to 39.49 degrees Celsius, and greater than 39.49 degrees Celsius.
And how about their primary outcome?
The primary outcome they looked at was in-hospital mortality.
So the author's conclusions were, quote, contrary to common perceptions and current guidelines for care of critically ill septic patients, increased body temperature in the emergency department was strongly associated with lower mortality and shorter hospital stays in patients with severe sepsis or septic shock subsequently admitted to the ICU. All right, Jesse, let's go through the quality checklist for observational studies. The first question, did the study address a clearly focused issue?
That's a yes.
Did the authors use an appropriate method to answer their question?
Also, yes.
Did they recruit the cohort in an acceptable way?
Yes.
Was the exposure accurately measured to minimize bias?
Unsure on that one.
How about the outcome? Was it accurately measured to minimize bias?
Yes.
Have the authors identified all important confounding factors?
Also, unsure on that one.
Was the follow-up of subjects complete enough?
Yes.
How precise were the results?
Very precise.
Do you believe the results, Jesse?
Yes, I do.
Do you think you can apply them to your local population?
Little unsure on that.
And the final question, did the results of this study fit with the other available evidence?
That's unsure. There's not a lot to guide practice in this area currently.
All right, let's run through the key results. They got a total of just over 2,000 patients included in their main analysis. The median age was 68 years and 56% were male. How about that primary outcome?
Well, the primary outcome was in-hospital mortality was inversely correlated with body temperature.
Yeah, for each 1 degree increase in body temperature, there was an observed 5% decrease in mortality. And we'll put a table in the show notes that shows those four temperature groups. But from less than 37 degrees Celsius, the mortality was 36%. And if you were above 39.49 degrees Celsius, the mortality was observed to be 15.5%. But let's talk a little nerdy. You know this is my favorite section.
How many points are we going to talk about, do you think, Ken?
Oh, I think that 4 would not be quite enough. 6 would be 1 too many. So let's go with 5, and you've got the first one.
Okay, so the first one is that this was an observational study. So we can only conclude associations and not causation due to the nature of this study. So lack of mounting a fever could just be a surrogate marker of frailty. In addition, different temperature groups had different primary focus of infection and different organisms identified. Those with fevers were treated more aggressively by looking at the quality of care markers. They tried to adjust for these factors, but some unmeasured confounder could be responsible for the observed inverse correlation between body temperature and mortality.
And the second nerdy point we wanted to mention was the measurement error and antipyretics. There was a lack of a uniform way to measure body temperature. Some had it tympanically done, some oral, and some rectal. This could have resulted in measurement error. Information about antipyretics or immune-modifying drugs prior to arrival to the emergency department was also lacking. This is important as many of our medical services still routinely give antipyretics for fever, and common community perception is still to take antipyretics for high temperature.
Yes, and point number 3 was the treatment. This study doesn't provide information on whether or not antipyretics should be given to septic or septic shock patients in the intensive care unit. We mentioned in the background information, the study of using IV acetaminophen in the ICU did not result in benefit.
The fourth point was about the severity score. They did not calculate a severity score like SOFA. This makes it difficult to adjust for disease severity. However, they did adjust for age, sex, underlying comorbidity, vital signs, preliminary focus of infection, and sepsis bundle achievement, and the inverse correlation between body temperature and mortality, it still remained. And pragmatically, the information required for SOFA would not be available immediately to the emergency physician or nurse.
Yeah, good point. So point number 5 was missing data. A large proportion of patients in this study had missing data. Only 58% of the patients had complete information on all variables. 9% did not even have a body temperature documented. Missing values were more prevalent in patients without fever. So that is the lower quality of care was held through with that patient group. While potentially biasing the quantitative prognostic accuracy of the study, this does actually confirm the need to pay greater attention to the quality of care and documentation for afebrile septic patients.
Well, that ends the 5 nerdy points, so it's time to comment on the author's conclusion compared to the SGEM's conclusion.
Well, I think both of us actually generally agree with the author's conclusion.
How about an SGEM bottom line?
Well, the SGEM bottom line is really we should pay greater attention to patients presenting with features of severe sepsis and septic shock that do not have a fever in the emergency department, as they are associated with a higher mortality rate.
And can you give us a case resolution? In this case, you presented 2 patients presenting to the emergency department. So how did you resolve these cases?
Yeah, well, this was that logistical dilemma that we're really confronted with quite frequently. So in this particular case, the one senior physician and 2 of the 3 nurses on shift in the high acuity area attended to the initial treatment of the patient without a fever. He required rapid fluid administration and treatment with empirical antibiotics. He also needed the initiation of a vasopressor for the short term via the peripheral cannula until a central line could be placed. The intensive care unit was involved early and they facilitated transfer. The other gentleman with a fever received further assessment by the remaining nurse and junior resident. He responded well to 30 mL per kilo of intravenous crystalloid, empirical antibiotics, and was safely admitted under the internal medicine team to the ward in the early hours of the morning.
So now it's time, Jesse, to reflect back on this study and think, how can you take this information and apply it clinically?
I guess when we were talking nerdy, a couple of the points that we did mention going through the OBS checklist was that we were unsure about is because it's really difficult to say what to do with this observational data in a concrete way. The clinical application may be to augment the triage of patients presenting with characteristics of severe sepsis or septic shock, flagging those without fever as having a greater risk of poor outcome and allocating resources accordingly. This could reframe the common perception that fever is a marker of acuity in sepsis, which may sort of be reflected in the results of that, those poorer quality of care and sort of missing data fields in the afebrile group in this study.
And I think it's important because we do have observational data to have those terms in there, may, which of course could be substituted with may not. So we're not really coming down hard on saying thou shalt do this and thou shalt not do that. I think it just raises our awareness of, hey, this could represent interesting information that we need to pay attention to. This person doesn't have a fever, and what does that mean? But how are you going to take that information to the patient's bedside?
Yeah, well, there's some subtle differences in the conversation, I guess. So to the patient without fever, you're very sick with a serious skin infection. However, you do not seem to have a natural response of a fever, and this makes us more worried. We would like to treat you very rapidly, and there would be a lot of activity getting antibiotics, blood tests, giving you some fluids, and quite possibly medications to raise your blood pressure. We'll be monitoring you very closely, and we'll very likely get the intensive care team to come and see you.
And how about for the other patient, the one with a fever?
Well, this would feel a little bit more in our normal comfort zone, I guess. You are very sick with a serious skin infection once again. Your body seems to be fighting it with a fever. Lowering your body temperature has not been shown to save lives, but it could make you feel better. The most important things right now are about getting you intravenous antibiotics, some intravenous fluids, and admitting you to hospital.
All right, let's do the Keener contest. Last week's winner was Matthew Smith from Liverpool, England. I had the pleasure of meeting him last year while I was in England. He knew that oncologists use dexamethasone to treat cancer patients vomiting and also increase their appetite. What's the question this week, Jesse?
The question this week is, which animal species are able to behaviorally induce fever in a whole of colony response to a fungal parasite?
Oh, I like that you came up with this question. I would have to say it was a very, sweet question. Well, if you know the answer to this week's Keener question, then send an email to thesjam@gmail.com with Keener in that subject line. The first correct answer will receive a cool skeptical prize. There is some other FOMED resources out there, and I will put a couple of links in the show notes so you can read those as well. Thanks, Jesse, for finally being able to come on the SGEM.
Thanks so much for the invite, Ken. With all due skepticism, I learned a truckload.
Well, I hope that this is your first. Yeah, you like how I put that? The first of your appearances on the SGEM, because we need to work together as a team. So I really like to have other team members, not just physicians, on the SGEM. So I've had physiotherapists, I've had PAs, I've had EMS, but having a nurse, I mean, we work with nurses day in and day out, and we need to work well together. And so knowing the literature and talking about how to apply the literature, I think gives patients the best possible care.
Couldn't agree more.
Well, it's that time. Can you give the SGEM tagline?
Be honored to. Remember to be skeptical of anything you learn, even if you heard it on the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine.
Talk to everyone next time. Some like it hot. Some like it hot.